Nuclear communications. The nuclear industry spends millions of dollars every year on public relations, promotion, focus groups to determine talking points, producing pro-nuclear events, and a full-time staff of propagandists writing press releases disguised as news stories for World Nuclear News. It's hard to get the word out from those of us who oppose nuclear, regardless of our credentials, and the list of footnotes we have for backing up everything that we're saying. Why doesn't more information that opposes nuclear get out into the world? It's perplexing. But then you hear from a writer and filmmaker who also does activist work, and for just one example of her experience in trying to get out the word that nukes are not clean, green, and sustainable, and she relates her experience on a lobbying trip to Congress. And she tells you,
"We went and spoke with six different senators and their staff as to why nuclear is not safe and clean and green, and gave the reasons why. And one guy fell asleep, and I had to wake him up. I'm like, excuse me. He's, oh, sorry, I have a newborn baby at home. I'm exhausted. I'm like, well, exactly. This is why you need to be listening."
And there are other stories as well. So when Jill Murphy Brown lets us know that Congress is literally asleep at the nuclear switch, and then moves on to create tools that will enable media content creators an easier way to contact genuine experts who share our perspective, you get yet another glimpse of what's keeping us in that terrible, awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with writer, filmmaker, and Three Mile Island activist Jill Murphy Brown. She talks about her history with TMI and her recent efforts to create tools that will help get the voices and information of genuine experts who oppose nuclear into mainstream media. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness. Alistair Burnett of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons with the ICAN update on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And we'll have more honest nuclear information than Trump and Musk ever discussed with each other during their recent breakup. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, June 10th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting in the U.S. in Illinois, where legislation that would have lifted a moratorium on the building of large-scale nuclear facilities failed to get through the Illinois General Assembly this spring, and that legislative session is now closed. In 2023, Illinois lifted a partial moratorium on nuclear power development, specifically to allow for small modular reactors. Governor J.B. Pritzker has said that he would be open to expanding nuclear power in the state, and continued, "We're looking forward to having a bill that comes to my desk that will allow us to expand the options for nuclear in the state of Illinois, but it has to be done the right way." But Dave Kraft, director of the Illinois-based Nuclear Energy Information Service, said in light of President Donald Trump signing executive orders which effectively gut the regulatory power of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, there is no, quote, right way. Kraft said, the questionable level of current regulation, and now the further erosion of even that via the executive orders, are not the conditions calling for more nuclear power. He added that current reactors are showing signs of aging, and new reactors would require greater oversight during the startup phase. And with reduced regulatory oversight, neither is safe. We will be discussing the issues involved here further on next week's Nuclear Hot Seat with a featured interview with Dave Kraft of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, or NEIS, which is based in Chicago. This item from Jason Sally of the Ohio Atomic Press: the U.S. Department of Energy, or DOE, has announced 3 new federally backed nuclear research projects under its GAIN, which stands for Gateway for Accelerated Innovation in Nuclear. I swear they have some guy locked in a closet in a back room who does nothing but come up with these acronyms. The GAIN program, raising renewed concerns from environmental and public safety advocates about the government's continued investment in high-risk nuclear technologies. These awards are framed as vouchers and don't provide cash to companies directly, but instead they allow businesses to access taxpayer-funded national laboratories and DOE technical staff to pursue projects aimed at modernizing components for nuclear reactors. Critics argue they only deepen U.S. dependence on a controversial energy source that's still struggling with radioactive waste, aging infrastructure, and unresolved environmental contamination. There's a terrific and very insightful article from Counterpunch entitled "Trump's Nuclear Power Obsession," and it's written by two titans of nuclear reporting, Carl Grossman and Harvey Wasserman. It starts out, "Donald Trump on May 23rd declared nuclear power to be a hot industry. Nuclear power plants are, quote, very safe and environmental," he said. He made the claims as he issued executive orders to quadruple nuclear energy capacity in the United States. But he failed to mention that nuclear power plants are subject to catastrophic accidents, such as the Fukushima, Chernobyl, and Three Mile Island disasters. And in routine operation, they release deadly radioactive emissions. Also, the nuclear fuel cycle, including mining, milling, and enrichment of nuclear fuel, is highly carbon intensive. And they go on from there to address every aspect of the executive orders that the president has been issuing and what's wrong with them. We will, of course, link to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 728. Over to Japan, where the Tokyo High Court has overturned a lower court ruling that held former executives of Tokyo Electric Power Company Holdings Incorporated, or TEPCO, liable for damages over the disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Station. This reverses a lower court order for 4 executives to pay over 13 trillion yen, the equivalent of around 89.5 billion U.S. dollars, to the company. The lawsuit was filed by shareholders of the company, questioning the managerial responsibility of the executives. The point of contention was whether the tsunami that caused the accident could have been anticipated. The district court, the lower court, found that the government's long-term assessment, which noted the possibility of a massive earthquake, was, quote, scientifically reliable. But the high court found that it had a weak basis and that, quote, it could not be helped that the former executives had no sense of urgency, end quote. The plaintiffs and their lawyers say they plan to appeal the ruling. Also regarding Fukushima, the Tokyo-based Citizens Nuclear Information Center, or CNIC, has reported that the total number of Fukushima Prefecture's evacuees, both outside the prefecture and inside the prefecture, is 24,639 people. This according to government figures. But the CNIC says that the number of voluntary evacuees is not included in the figures, and that when evacuation orders are lifted, those people who are still living as evacuees are excluded from the statistics. The actual number of people living in the zones, it says, is a difference of 38,606 people. According to CNIC, quote, "The current statistics are unable to capture the realities of the situation and are little more than a recovery masquerade." A law enabling nuclear reactors in Japan to operate beyond 60 years took effect on Friday, June 7, scrapping a limit imposed after the Fukushima crisis. The law replaces rules allowing the operation of reactors for up to 40 years, with extensions up to 60 years possible if approved by regulators. The 40-year limit was imposed by the original engineers who designed the first nuclear reactors, because they said that after 40 years of containing a nuclear reaction, the bombardment of the concrete and other materials in the containment shell would become brittle. The term they use is embrittlement. And once that structure becomes embrittled, it is more prone to cracks, leaks, and catastrophic damage. But nuclear reactors that have already been built are cash cows, and now Japan wants to be able to milk them not just for their initial 40 years, not even 60, but to move it 20 years beyond that to 80 years, twice the operating limit that was originally intended by those who built the first reactors. The Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, or METI, will assess the extension periods of nuclear reactors beyond 60 years. And we will link to an editorial from the Asahi Shimbun headlined, "Social Agreement Needed for Disposing of Fukushima Soil." The two main measures are to recycle some of this soil and to eventually dispose of all the soil outside of Fukushima Prefecture. However, no course for those measures has been laid down because of the difficulties in finding a location to serve as a final disposal site. The plan is to use about 3/4 of the total volume of the radioactive soil in public works projects in various parts of Japan. And the government said that measures would be taken to prevent the soil from becoming airborne or spilling out from the work site to protect workers and local residents, which is not possible because the soil will be blown about by the wind as dust. The water will soak into the land. The land will grow plants, some of them edible, which will contain the radionuclides, and the mess will just keep spreading. Now, with the latest on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, direct from the headquarters of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons in Geneva, Switzerland, here's the ICANN update with their head of media, Alistair Burnett.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett from ICANN in Geneva with the latest news from the campaign. On Friday the 13th of June, mark the date, ICANN is publishing its annual Global Nuclear Weapons Spending Report that looks at how much each of the 9 nuclear-armed states spent on nuclear weapons in the previous year. Will the US again spend more than the other 8 countries combined as it did last year? In 2023, $91 billion was spent. Did it top $100 billion in 2024? You'll have to wait and see. ICANN's preparations for this year's events to mark the 80th anniversary of the invention and first use of nuclear weapons continue. Our executive director, Melissa Park, will be attending commemorative events in New Mexico and meeting campaigners and survivors of the first nuclear test explosion, Trinity, and the hundreds of test detonations that followed in the region, to express our solidarity and support for them. The British government has just published a major review of its defence strategy, and it's deeply worrying. The review recommends Britain buys US aircraft capable of dropping nuclear bombs and, by implication, the weapons that go with them. The government has said it accepts the recommendations in full. ICANN and our UK partners have called this out as both escalatory and irresponsible. We've also pointed out it's contrary to the UK's commitments to move towards disarmament under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. All these recent negative developments in Europe, with governments talking up the illusory importance of nuclear weapons for their security, raises the question of how the US will react, given President Trump's comments about wanting to discuss denuclearization with Russia and China. So I spoke to ICANN's deputy director, Daniel Hoekstra, who oversees our advocacy with nuclear-armed states and their allies, about whether this talk of denuclearization could actually lead anywhere.
This is a big question. I think we have to see it in two ways. I mean, of course, given what we see, we cannot take Trump's words at face value. I mean, he's not a trustworthy actor. He's clearly not genuinely committed to peace in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, he made grand statements about nuclear weapons in his first term. Let's remember the whole summit with Kim, North Korea, which ultimately resulted in nothing. And there's the whole nuclear weapons industry. It's extremely profitable for a certain group of stakeholders. It's a kind of an endless money pot for some in the US. And there's the whole architecture that kind of supports the command and control of nuclear weapons. There are the labs, there are the producers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin. So there's that. And of course, I think something that's also perhaps not as kind of in the fore is the external pressure on the US, right? We often think of the US as kind of exerting pressure on its allies vis-a-vis nuclear weapons, but there's actually also pressure coming the other way. I mean, apparently, when the Obama administration floated the possible shift to a no first use policy, there was significant pushback from allies. It was reported in media that Japan, in particular, pushed back on that. They didn't want to see any perceived weakening of the deterrent. So, although let's remember right now, we're also seeing a lot of panic among the US's NATO allies about the credibility of its commitment to the alliance, including its commitment to the nuclear weapons part of that. A lot of this talk is a response to the fear about the US not being a reliable partner, which it probably never was, by the way. But it's probably also an attempt to rattle the US into recommitting. On the other hand, Donald Trump is an extremely unpredictable character. And he has, over the course of his presidency and going back to his time before politics, he's demonstrated a kind of fascination with nuclear weapons and a recognition of how dangerous and expensive they are. Perhaps he also remembers the Reagan-Gorbachev summit, and Donald Trump being someone also who wants to have a legacy as a peacemaker and was very fascinated by the Nobel Peace Prize. Perhaps he's also thinking about that. And of course, things are happening that are kind of that were previously thought as unthinkable. Unfortunately, these are all really bad things with really tragic outcomes for people. There's the dismantlement of the foreign aid system. There's all the horrific things that are happening on the immigration side of things. But if he wants to leave some kind of positive legacy on nuclear weapons, he probably could do so.
He's also used some really extraordinary language for a US president around nuclear weapons. He's called the money spent on modernization a complete waste, given there are enough weapons to destroy the world over already many times. He almost sounds like an anti-nuclear campaigner at times. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's kind of really unfortunate that he is certainly the only US president that has ever spoken in this kind of way, and the only leader of any of the nuclear weapon states that is willing to acknowledge the massive money pot and the wasted money that nuclear weapons are. So, I mean, we as campaigners in ICAN and nuclear disarmament movement more generally, we can't afford to ignore this. We have to pay attention to it. We have to see if there's opportunities there. I mean, I think it's extremely dark time when it comes to nuclear weapons right now. But during the Cold War, it was at the darkest times that major advances were made. So we have to continue to prepare the ground for change. We have to sensitize people about the dangers of nuclear weapons. We have to grow as much support and awareness of the TPNW as possible, as many Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, as many states joining it, so that when an opportunity does present itself, whether it be this year under Trump or in the years to come, we're kind of ready to catch that wave and use the momentum that we've built to make some real breakthroughs for nuclear disarmament.
Yes, because the signs are quite sort of contradictory from the Trump administration. Because while talking about the need to cut spending and denuclearize, as he puts it, the administration has asked for a $1 trillion budget for the Pentagon. It started producing a new generation of nuclear bombs. I think they're called the B-6113, ahead of schedule. And it's moved ahead with the project for a sea-launched nuclear cruise missile that many experts say is simply not needed. So there's this potential actions speak louder than words argument here, isn't there?
Absolutely. These are kind of moves. These are intended to guarantee that the next generation is also, burdened by these weapons, that the contracts are signed now, the construction starts now, and it will continue for decades. So the next generation will be burdened by this as well. It's all words. when it comes to denuclearization and really no action, quite the contrary.
Russia has been the focus of much of the, as it were, the fear mongering in Europe and North America about the potential for nuclear conflict and therefore the need for more nuclear weapons. But there's also China, which is identified as a longer term threat, with the Pentagon predicting that China would have over 1,500 nuclear warheads by the mid 2030s, although the evidence for that is, of course, is not there. It's not presented anyway to the public. But the Trump administration at the same time is ratcheting up tensions with China over trade while asking Beijing to talk about nuclear disarmament or arms control. And this doesn't seem a very likely way to push forward denuclearization on a global scale if you're alienating a country on the one hand and saying, oh, please disarm on the other.
This highlights exactly why this so-called kind of great power approach to nuclear disarmament is doomed to fail. It's kind of ironic that nuclear disarmament advocates are accused of being naive when and not linked with reality when it's this notion of the step-by-step approach, which you hear so often from nuclear weapon states in multilateral forums. I mean, this step-by-step approach assumes the P5, not to mention the other nuclear weapon states, will negotiate in good faith while they're actively competing and undermining each other in every other arena in the way that you described with the US and China right now. I mean, but I think we are the realists actually who are saying that based on the evidence before us, a perfectly peaceful environment where there's no competition, economic or otherwise, between these governments will, and certainly no conflicts, will probably never exist and certainly cannot exist while we have nuclear weapons. And so that's precisely why we need the TPNW approach. It's kind of the multilateral humanitarian focused disarmament that doesn't depend on the geopolitical mood between the superpowers that has the best chance of success. Real progress on denuclearization requires addressing the underlying security concerns that drive nuclear weapon programs, and you can't do that while simultaneously escalating tensions in other critical areas.
That was Daniel Hoekstra, and this is Alistair Burnett ending this news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
That was Alistair Burnett with the latest on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons from ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. You can sign up for their newsletter and follow their latest on their website, icanw.org. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, 3 days from now, marks the anniversary of the start of Nuclear Hot Seat on June 14, 2011. And next week will be the start of the 15th year of this weekly show. When I awkwardly cobbled together a conference call that I labeled a podcast, I had no idea that all this time later, I would still be presenting a weekly roundup of nuclear news from that all-important different perspective. It's been the journey of a lifetime, getting to know the issues, our history, locations of the problems and disasters, ongoing dangers, official manipulations and languaging lies, and most importantly, getting to meet the brave, committed, heart-centered people in our community who are dedicatedly fighting against nuclear. That would be you. Along the way, I've regularly beat out mainstream media on nuclear stories, gotten my stories ripped off by lazy reporters and acknowledged by good ones who cite this show as a source, traveled to locations to bring you stories of events and anniversaries, and tried my best to keep up with the multi-million-dollar PR juggernaut that is nuclear. At times, it felt like all I was doing was narrating the rearrangement of the deck chairs on the Titanic, but at others, I knew and I know that the information I'm able to provide helps focus important attention on activist groups and issues that might otherwise be ignored. Above all, I have sought always to keep our movement in good heart. So in honor of this start of our 15th year, now would be the perfect time for you to honor this work with a donation. How about $15 for a symbolic acknowledgement? You could do this as a one-time donation or ongoing. Or $5, same as a cup of coffee, any amount. We run exclusively on donations, and without your support, we won't be able to continue. So let's keep it going. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button for a one-time donation or to set up an ongoing donation, or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Go to Nuclear Hot Seat to donate now and honor the start of our 15th year. Whatever you can do, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Jill Murphy Long is a professional writer who writes, directs, and produces films based on the ethics of justice, mercy, and love. And those are the initials of her company, JML Films. She is the force behind 9 completed feature film screenplays and more than 40 short films that spotlight current-day environmental and social injustices. Jill's anti-nuclear perspective originated with her personal experience living near the 1979 meltdown at Three Mile Island and her resulting brain tumor in 2012 and thyroid cancer in 2023. Fortunately, her health is currently good. Now, she's creating a database of nuclear content creators, writers, filmmakers, and podcasters for distribution to those who create podcasts, broadcasts, and other in the news and entertainment industries to promote our stories and the perspective that nuclear is definitely not clean, green, and renewable energy. I spoke with Jill Murphy Long on May 16, 2025. Jill Murphy Long, it is great to be talking with you this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Let's start out with a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up and what was that like?
I was born and raised in Pennsylvania. I was born in Scranton. But by the time I was a teenager, we moved down to York, Pennsylvania, after living near Penn State in Belleville, Pennsylvania. The first 19 years of my life, I was in Pennsylvania.
When you moved there, what was your family's awareness of or concerns about the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor? This is before the accident.
Yeah, we moved to York when I was going into sixth grade, and I was shocked because we didn't talk about it. Yeah, Three Mile Island was called a super plant. It has 4 cooling towers that stand, you know, hundreds of feet above the trees on the island in the middle of the Susquehanna River. But short of seeing the steam come out of those cooling towers we drove by, we never gave it a second thought because we were told repeatedly it's safe. There's no harm to public health or safety. So we believed them. My mom was a little bit upset because my godfather, Uncle John, is a researching doctor and scientist at Albert Einstein. And he said, I don't know if it's a good idea to live that close to a nuclear power plant. But my father had just accepted a very good job. And we said yes.
How far away were you?
I did an aerial measurement recently. And our house was up on a ridgeline, up on a hill. As a bird flies, a crow flies, it's about 13.33 miles, air miles. And on a clear day, you could see the steam rising from Three Mile Island.
Where were you when the accident happened, and what was that experience like for you?
Again, I was a teenager, so a little bit oblivious, kind of busy with boys and books and sports. And my brother and I, it was actually Wednesday, March 28th. I was 15, he's 14. As a typical day, we got up, went to school. And then after school, both Mike and I were 5 sports athletes. And this time of year in March, it was track season. So we were at track practice after school outside. And my school, York Senior High School, is only about 12 miles from Three Mile Island. And we're out there outside with about 100 other kids exercising, running around. And then we went home. Mike and I were also the newspaper boy and girl. So we delivered the York Dispatch. So we split the neighborhood. So we knew all our neighbors. We did this for 6 years. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we are outside for track practice, not knowing, because they didn't even know it was a meltdown until 5 years later. So first something happened at Three Mile Island. Then Thursday, everything's fine. Then Friday, they evacuated pregnant mothers and small children from Middletown, where Three Mile Island exists. So it was really scary once that happened.
What, if anything, were you told about the dangers after the accident?
Nothing. I mean, they didn't even know until 5 years later that there was a 2.5-foot by 5-foot hole in Unit 1 inside the nuclear reactor and that the fuel rods had melted at the base. They weren't able to get people in there because it was too radioactive. And it was still too radioactive 5 years later when they sent five teams of five men each. 25 men went in there. And I spoke to one recently. I hope he's still here. I have not heard from him lately, so I'm very concerned. But he said they've all died. He was the only one left. And he had pictures and he sent me the transcripts. But basically, they put on the bodysuit that you would wear to go surfing, like a dry suit with a hood, and then the hazmat suit. And then they would tape down the wrists and their ankles and the respirator and a dosimeter, and they would go in there to place cameras. They didn't make it. And it was so hot. A, they're already, you know, bundled up and it's hot. You know, nuclear fuel is hot.
When you say it's hot, are you talking about temperature hot, radiologically hot, or both?
Both. And they were scared. So because of these brave souls, they put the cameras in there and they were able to see the hole. They were able to see the melted spent fuel rods. And that's what we saw in 1986 after Chernobyl melted down. So again, they didn't tell us anything. They kept repeating, and they do that till today after other accidents and leaks. There's been no harm to public health or safety. And even if you go on their websites, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the World Nuclear Association, all the different bodies that govern nuclear today, they'll say there's been no deaths. Well, I'm sorry, there's been a lot of deaths, and I've plotted them all.
What happened to your family and their health after Three Mile Island? How do you believe they were affected, including yourself, by the 1979 meltdown?
The first casualty, unfortunately, was my mother in 1984. We thought she died of heart complications, which she did, but I believe it was exacerbated by being exposed to iodine radiation that was released from Three Mile Island in 1979. So very shortly after she died.
And it is well known that heart issues are among those that show up after exposure to ionizing radiation, the kind that come from this kind of an accident.
We were devastated. 20 years later, my father died of a massive heart attack. So again, it just solidified my belief that something happened at Three Mile Island that they didn't tell us. Fast forward to 2005. In a span of 7 years, my brother called. The first time he called and said, I have a brain tumor. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, you're on the cell phone too much. The second time he called, 3 years later, he goes, I have basal cell carcinoma. I go, what's that? Because we're healthy. Nobody's sick in my family. He goes, it's skin cancer. I said, well, that's because you live in Florida. And then the third time he called, April 2012, he said, I have thyroid cancer. And by that point, I had heard from classmates and teachers and neighbors that people were also getting sick. And in that same year, 2012, in September, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Did you make the connection immediately to Three Mile Island? And how are you doing? What's your health like now?
Yeah, after my brother had called two times, and I heard from classmates that it died of leukemia before 40, brain cancer before 40, prostate cancer, breast cancer. I mean, the list goes on and on. I started reading everything I could on Three Mile Island, including the president's report on the accident. They call it accident, even though they knew it was a meltdown. So I did a deep dive into everything I could find, and I was shocked. I started really looking at what happened and what we were told, and also what was happening in other parts of the country and world, and cross comparing, you know, overlaying them and going, this doesn't make sense. And then I got sick. I had to take a break because I had to deal with what I was going through. You know, when they cut your head open, it's kind of severe. I woke up in intensive care. And the good news was I started talking like I'm talking now. And I asked for paper and pencil and I started writing. So I'm fine.
Now, you said you had started your journey with all of this research before the brain tumor interrupted your flow. How did you become an activist on this, or where did you pick up the work and focus it when you first got active?
I was just really concerned what was happening in my hometown. You know, I'd lived there for quite a while. I have good friends I still contact today. So I flew home and I had the idea, how do I get this word out? So I decided I'm going to write a movie. I held about six parties in 2 weeks and had people come and tell me what happened to them and started collecting testimonials, which then I plotted on Google Maps, which you can access today and see where do they live in 1979 and what's happened to them since then. And that's what gave me the fire, in addition to what happened to my family, but what happened to 5,000 other people, why people need to know what happened at Three Mile Island in 1979.
What work have you done in conjunction with some of the other notable activists or groups in the area, like Three Mile Island Alert, or when Mary Osborne Stamos, the late Mary Osborne Stamos, was doing her research into plant mutations and also collecting data? Did you have any connection with them and did you work with them?
Yes, Mary was incredible. She came to one of our events and brought all her documentation and took up a whole room and spread out photographs of what she saw, the plant mutation, two-headed cows, which no one believed her, which was not, we did, the people in the room believed her, but she wasn't getting any traction with the media. So I'm so glad the Smithsonian has now accepted her work and is showing that. I met with reporters that were there at Ground Zero who came to the events as well and shared their story from when they first saw there was no steam coming out of the top of the cooling towers. I've spoken numerous times with Eric Epstein of TMI Alert and his crew, and he's making headway. But he did send me some other people that I also included in our testimonial. So we're trying to work together to be heard.
What has been your approach to government with your findings, and what has been the response when you've talked with government representatives?
By 2022, I was very annoyed with nothing happening. People that don't know what happens when a nuclear reactor melts down, in the media who keeps repeating the one side of the story that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission keeps saying. I went to DC. I went and protested with about 200 some people in front of the EPA building. We had 12 foot high colored yellow letters that said, EPA, do your job. And we wheeled them in on the little dollies in front of the building. I took 12 hazmat suits, stuffed them with paper towels, stuck them on sticks, and we carried these headless hazmat men around. We put the sticker that's on a nuclear shelter fallout on the chest, and then had another sticker. So that's, you know, the yellow and black symbol, and then red letters, not in my body. So we paraded these headless men around and tried, you know, media came and did some coverage, and that was great. But the next couple of days, I met with an atomic veteran and his daughter, and then some other people in DC that are activists. And we went and spoke with six different senators and their staff as to why nuclear is not safe and clean and green, and gave the reasons why. And one guy fell asleep, and I had to wake him up. I'm like, excuse me. He's, oh, sorry, I have a newborn baby at home. I'm exhausted. I'm like, well, exactly. This is why you need to be listening. The latent nature of being exposed to ionizing radiation affected me at 15. Here I am now in my 50s. It's going to affect you and your child, because it's not just in my backyard in Pennsylvania. United States winds. We have 99 operating nuclear reactors in the country. And if they're not operating, they're decommissioned, which doesn't matter. They still have their nuclear waste there. So I said, you need to pay attention to this. But it fell on deaf ears because the lobbyists got there first with their money. So that just pushed me to, now I'm writing a book.
You're also writing a documentary and also a feature documentary series. Where are they in terms of their development? And are you at the point yet where these are going to be promoted to the outside world?
Yes, I hope all three get what they call the green light and get funded. So Plutonium Skies is a feature film based on what happened to me. It's similar to Aaron Brockovich, but it picks up after Oppenheimer. So that screenplay has been shopped in Los Angeles. I've had numerous production companies interested. I've gone through numerous producers, but anyone that's worked in LA, this is par for the course. People get excited, it gets put down, it gets picked up, it gets put down. So I got aggravated and said, you know what? Let's do something to address climate change. So the second production I wrote was called Powerhouse, and it's a multi-episodic TV docu-series where I want celebrities and an A-list actor to go out and make these discoveries. I'll take them to Trojan. I'll take them to Three Mile Island. I'll take them to Trojan Park in my backyard, San Onofre and San Clemente, and basically do a reveal of what I found out and then tell them the facts. The second half of the show will be about the safe, clean, green, renewable solutions that the rest of the world are already implementing. And when I say I'll take them to hotspots, I won't. Luckily, we have green screens and B-roll, so it'll be very safe. I'm not going to expose anybody to radiation. So that's, those two film productions hopefully will happen once the book's out, and I'm working on the book now.
And what is the book focused on?
So it's on the hotspots in America and also other places around the world that they need to be aware of.
One of the things I learned by looking over your materials before this interview is that there is work being done testing to prove radioactive contamination of the land and the trees around Three Mile Island. What is this work and what has been your involvement in it?
I petitioned the EPA, the CDC, the NIH, and nothing. They would review my petitions and get back 6 months later and go, nope, there's nothing. There's no reason why we should come check your soil. You have to do it yourself if you believe so. So that's what I'm trying to do now. In my backyard in Pennsylvania, we had a creek that would flood our backyard and our downstairs every spring. I want them to test that because in six houses above that creek and beside it, there's 26 different diagnoses. They will also test the trees because if you get a tree that's 50 years old and you take a pencil size pore into the tree, you can see the history of what the tree has lived through. So between the soil and the tree sampling, we'll be able to say what is in our water and our land in Pennsylvania, as they did in Chernobyl. We went over there, our government, 30 years later, thinking they could open up Chernobyl, the area, the exclusionary zone, and let people come back there to live. And they went, oh, no, it's still radioactive. And we think it might be radioactive for 180 to 300 years because nature moves things around. And it gets in the water, it gets in the eddies, it gets in the air and back in the soil again. It's still radioactive.
And the radiation doesn't go away, as you pointed out. On Nuclear Hot Seat number 724, I interviewed Jason Sally, who is an investigative journalist who's deeply invested in covering the problems in Piketon, Ohio, with the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant. And it's being demolished, but not in a way that's safe for the surrounding community. And one of the stories he told me about that he is working on right now has to do with a lumber yard that was, fence butt up against the Portsmouth plant, and that they had trees there that were not only growing that were harvested from the local area, but that were stored there. And now the lumber yard has gone under. And they've sold off what they have. And apparently, it has been purchased by the Mead Paper Company. And they will be taking this wood and turning it into paper products, which means we have no tracking of where that possibly radioactive, not that they've tested it, but let's get real, it's very likely radioactive wood might end up in the school notebooks of children or in offices or wherever it might turn up. So, this is a problem that not only doesn't go away, but it gets repeated and spread. And with radiation having a half-life, certainly plutonium is 24,000 years before it's half as dangerous as it is right now, and it's the most dangerous substance on Earth, or any of the other radionuclides where it's shorter, but they're still active, it never goes away. So the fact that you are testing the soil, you are testing the trees, I think is crucial to understanding the long-lasting nature of the problem and where and how it shows up generations after the initial contamination happened.
And that's why I have a Geiger counter now. My friend Donna Gilmore, who was down at San Onofre fighting them forever, moved up to the Bay Area. I was on the phone with her and she's, oh, someone just texted me. And it turned out her buddy had wood that was radioactive because when he threw it on the fire, his Geiger counter next to it started going off and he couldn't figure out why. He's in Tahoe. What's radioactive in Lake Tahoe? Then he put it to the wood pile. And sure enough, it was radioactive wood. So 100%, what's happening in Ohio? Yeah, that wood is radioactive and it's radioactive for a very long time. Whether it ends up in a notebook or a book or wood or toilet paper, we are in trouble. This is not a good thing. And this is why it just irks me when they keep saying nuclear industry is safe, clean, and green. It is not, because our energy solution should not be radioactive for hundreds of centuries.
You have published a long list of groups and locations where you cite your work along with other advocates and activists, and it's a really long list. What does your work with them consist of, say, at the Santa Susana Field Lab in Southern California, or the Bikini Atoll, the Marshall Islanders down in the South Pacific?
I met Melissa Bumstead because I lived in Los Angeles area for 19 years. And I was mortified to find out about the Woodsley wildfire in 2018, which basically caught fire on the land that was known to be radioactive. It's the Santa Susana Field Lab, which is actually a nuclear lab. So many of us are doing really great work, but in our backyard, as a film producer, as a film director, I'm trying to bring everyone together. If we're together, we're going to be heard and be seen. So I'm asking all my author friends, you too, and all my filmmaker friends to join us. In addition, I'm also reaching out because I met two women that their father was coming here from the Marshall Islands for cancer treatment. Because after bombing the Marshall Islands, the Bikini Atolls for years, 318 bombs were detonated over there by us, by UK, and by France. There's no major hospital. So if people get sick, they bring them to Seattle or they bring them to Portland. So anyhow, I met them here and they were watching over their father who unfortunately passed. It's really tragic. So I'm also bringing the atomic vets together with us, all the activists and advocates, anyone that has something to say about nuclear. And I just joined the Samuel Lawrence Foundation, who is trying to get the 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste off the beach at San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant. And that's where they're hosting, in their genius, the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics. They're hosting the surfing competition on that beach. We already poisoned our athletes when we sent them to Tokyo when Fukushima had melted down in 2011. The food is radioactive over there. The water is radioactive, the seafood. Yet they just said, oh, you know, it's upriver, it's upstream, don't worry about it. But now we're going to host the surfing competition right in front of San Onofre. If you look up liquid batch release on the internet, San Onofre, it will tell you. They post it now because luckily the Surf Rider Foundation said, hey, we surf there. What's in our water? So now they tell you within 48 hours if they're going to release any treated water into the ocean.
You've recently held an online webinar, possibly more than one. What was this about and what has the response been to it?
I decided because everyone is so busy, we need to create a database. So I'm creating a database of authors and filmmakers, advocates, activists, and different groups who wants to see the United States go green, you know, use renewable energy that is safe, clean, and green from cradle to grave. So that's what I'm doing. I'm starting to pull these people together. And then in conjunction with the Samuel Lawrence Foundation, we are going to connect them to investigative reporters, media throughout the world who's interested in what is America doing now and get the story out. And then also connect them to each other because I'm writing a chapter about New Mexico. I know something about what happened at the Trinity bomb, but Lois Lipman, who wrote First They Bombed New Mexico, knows a lot. So I'm going to speak with her. I'm also speaking to another gentleman who did the documentary movie Downwind. So again, there's all these pockets of very informative people who know so much that we just need to know each other. So that's what we're doing because we're all tired. I mean, this industry has been going on for what, 80 years since we bombed Japan? So we need to join together so we can be heard and seen. And people can see why, when I say nuclear is not safe, clean, or green, why it's not.
In terms of your future plans, what's next for you?
I need to write the book proposal, pitch it to an agent, and get published. And at the same token, I'm also talking to production companies in Europe because, again, like I said before, Europe's kind of interested in what we're doing now in America. So I think because LA, I'm just not getting traction there, I'll turn to that market. And I have not done that yet. So I'm looking at that. And I do have two producers in LA that are supposedly helping me, but they're busy on their own project. So I think it's going to be up to me to get this done, the TV show, the feature film, and the book.
Anything else you'd like to share at this time?
When I went back to Pennsylvania, my old high school moved and the building's still the same. They changed the name. It's York Learning Center. So when I was touring it, I asked the woman that was giving us the tour, I said, well, who goes to school here now? Because I see children. And she goes, oh, we service a population ages 5 to 21 who have special needs, such as Asperger's, autism. How old would their mothers be in 1979? And she was, well, mainly, you know, preteens and teenagers. So that's what's happening. We're seeing the second and third generations affected by what happened at Three Mile Island. There's the York Autism Society now in York. There's that school and other schools that service that population. Asperger's with autism was not a common neurological disease. And now I know three people with it from my hometown. I mean, there's more than that. It's just two I know, but I'm just shocked. So that's what happens. That's the legacy of the nuclear industry. It keeps on giving because of the half-lives that stay active in our soil, our water, our food, in our bodies.
Jill, you're so busy with so many different projects. It's great to see. And I also want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
That was Jill Murphy Long. If you would like to apply to be listed on the Film, TV, Podcast, and Digital Database, send an email to scriptwriterjml@gmail.com. We'll have the link up on the website as well. And you can learn more about her work at her website, jmlfilms.com.
Activists, shout out.
The Physicians Coalition for Nuclear Threat Reduction is holding a webinar, Golden Dome, a Costly, Destabilizing, and Ineffective Missile Defense System. In this webinar, three physicists specializing in missile defense will examine why the proposed system would be technically ineffective, carry projected costs in the hundreds of billions of dollars or more, and exacerbate the global arms race dynamics. It's being held on June 23rd, 2025 at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. We will have a link up for that registration, which also includes further information on the webinar itself. It will be on the website nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 728. And if you're anywhere near Central Ohio, the Wilmington Peace Resource Center in Wilmington, Ohio, is calling for readers. 80 years after Hibakusha call us to remember the Hiroshima and Nagasaki vigil, the Peace Resource Center is staging a 12-hour Hiroshima and Nagasaki vigil on the 80th anniversary of the atomic bombings there. It consists of a communal reading of 80 testimonials by Hibakusha, atomic bomb sufferers. Testimonials that were curated from the Peace Resource Center Barbara Reynolds Memorial. They will need to be available on August 6th between the hours of 8:15 a.m. and 8:15 p.m. If you are interested in taking part in this very powerful and emotional event, contact the Peace Resource Center. You can do so via email at PRC, that's P like Peter, R, C like Cat, at wilmington.edu. And now for my personal favorite piece of activism that I have engaged in over the past few weeks. Here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
Having produced and hosted Nuclear Hot Seat every week for 14 years, I am often approached by people who claim to have problem-solving nuclear-related products and who have found me through the wonders of Google and LinkedIn. The most recent one provided me with a lot of, let's just say, entertainment. For legal reasons, I will not be mentioning the name of the person or the company. Initially, I was politely informed of their invention of, quote, a process that eradicates radiation. Eradicates? And they wanted my help in getting the word out. Well, which word? Eradicate? This individual goes on to brag, it destroys the nucleus of the atom, causing it to undergo a radical and unstable decay and, in the process, changes it to another element. Sounds a lot like the nuclear decay cycle that's already in place. He goes on, this new element creates a spontaneous decay that kills radiation in minutes instead of its half-life of millions of years. In other words, we speed up the process with our solution. Clearly, this man understands nothing about the difference in decay cycle between plutonium and, say, iodine-134. But he goes on, It's a liquid solution that is environmentally friendly, non-toxic, non-acidic, and reusable. I'll bet it tastes great, too. If there has been such a breakthrough, I'm wondering where the Nobel Prize is for solving this problem with radiation. So I asked for proof. He responds that the process has received, quote, certification by a radiochemist who used to work at Hanford. So, who is this guy? Who is he to certify? What is he certifying? What's the certification? Who oversees his determinations? And what makes you think this unsubstantiated claim is credible? All that is overlooked in the response when he admits we would not have paid him a lot of money to certify this process without knowing this was, is a solution for killing radiation. How much money was he paid and what is his name? My questions were not even acknowledged. But then he writes, if you are so skeptical, then I would invite you to see a demonstration, and then maybe you will believe it then. Bring your physicist if you wish. Ignoring the typos in what he sent, I responded, you're inviting me to see a quote-unquote demonstration. When? Where? What will it consist of? How long will it take? What accommodations will you make for me, and how much will you pay me to compensate for my time? His next response, much delayed, was curt, dissed me, used language I cannot repeat on this show because it goes against FCC regulations, and I do have broadcast station. And then he snapped in all caps, keep your criticism to yourself. Too late. Pro-nuclear human bots like you are my food and drink. And that's why Nuclear Shill, with a dubious product and a really flimsy sales pitch. If you're listening, you know who you are. You are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
I'd like to send him a certificate acknowledging this award, but I do not wish to waste the time, the energy, and I know he won't reimburse me for the postage. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 10th, 2025. Don't miss out on a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. And the easiest way to not miss it is to have it delivered via email every week. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a yellow opt-in box there that you really cannot miss. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one, just one, email. We don't bug you. That email will contain a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. Easy peasy and super convenient. So go ahead and do it. Sign up at nuclearhotseat.com. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember always, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you that, as former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Allison McFarland, said, a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. That's it. Your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.